Hey, it's Bikescape, episode number 37, December 11th, 2005. Bikescape. I'm gonna try and leave the music up while I talk. Hopefully this won't be too confusing. I've got a new method for mixing the music in. I hope this works. So, hi everybody. It's been a while. The podcasts have been few and far between this time of year. That's the way it is. But they're hopefully high quality when they do arrive at your doorstep. So you're out there riding on the streets. You see the cars, you see the sidewalks, you see the buses, a few taxis, there's lines down the middle of the street. How did it get that way? You know, is that what we really want when we have a street? You know, what is the street for? Is the street public space? Is it a place just to move a million cars through? Is it for transportation? Is it for, what's it for? Is it for for meeting people, for sidewalk cafes, for picnics, for sleeping on? Is it a place to grow your vegetables? There's so many ways to think of streets and public space where we all gather. And one of the ways that we've been looking at, you know, some of the forward-looking people have been thinking about streets have been within, you know, as lobby groups. I mean, there's those of us who like to convert with critical mass style actions. We turn the streets into something completely different for a short period of time. But then there's the more permanent, incremental things that have to happen in order to really make some changes. And for that, we have people who sit in offices and dream up ideas and go to the government and lobby and try to organize groups and coalitions. And one of the big ones is transportation for livable cities. And we went over to talk to somebody about that last week. And we being me, John, I'm your host for the evening. I went and talked to Tom Radulovich. Got a nice interview with him. Talked about transportation for livable communities. If I can find him on my desktop, I'll turn him on. Here he is.
Yeah, BART board, Bay Area Rapid Transit.
Hold on, I'm gonna start that over again. That's right.
We're here in downtown San Francisco with Tom Radulovich, and he is the executive director of Transportation for Livable Cities, and he's also on the BART board. Bay Area Rapid Transit District, which is the organization that runs the BART trains that connect the counties around the Bay Area. And we're here to talk to him. Welcome to Bikescape, by the way.
Thank you. Yeah, well, thanks for coming over to the glamorous corner of 6th and Market.
It is pretty glamorous. You can get this really unique view from the windows here. You can see, or you can definitely see all the major peaks.
It's true.
Yeah, all at once.
We're a 15-story building. It's kind of an ugly building, so it's great being in this building for two reasons. One is the view. Second of all, it's the only building in the neighborhood that you don't have to look at this building when you're in. So, and it's great being up here. We call it the Treehouse. We share it with the Bicycle Coalition and with Housing Action Coalition, and it's our kind of view on the city.
So what is the mission of TLC, Transportation for Livable Cities?
Transportation for Livable Cities has been around for almost 5 years now. We started in 2001. It initially grew out of the San Francisco Bicycle Coalition. We're definitely a pro-bike organization, but there was a kind of awareness growing in the Bike Coalition that they were part of looking at a larger transportation picture, this whole idea of livable city and sustainable transportation and how all of those things fit together. became TLC. So we look at all the sustainable transportation modes. We promote walking, we promote bicycling, we promote public transportation. And we also look at the implications of land use and that on the transportation system. And we also are looking at sort of the implications of our transportation choices on sustainability, this larger universe of environmental questions. And how do we become a sustainable society and sustainable civilization?
And to be more specific, mm-hmm. we're talking about, you basically based that mission on four pillars.
Yeah, for the last 2 years, we've sort of had four focus areas that we consider our strategic focus areas. The areas are looking at transportation funding, just making sure the money's flowing for the sorts of sustainable transportation infrastructure that we want. Also making sure that the way that we charge for transportation sends the right price signals, encourages the right behavior. The second area is looking at parking reform, again, for the same reason that parking is... how you price it, how much you have is a huge determinant of what transportation choices people make, how much congestion you have and all of that. And it's also a huge resource in terms of money. If we price it right, then there's money to do the other things we want. We are promoting complete streets, the idea that streets should be designed for all users, not just the automobile. And lastly, we're promoting the idea of car-free living, and that sort of is... related to complete streets, complete neighborhoods, designing complete and balanced neighborhoods where you can accomplish everything you need, get everywhere you need via the sustainable transportation modes.
Yeah. Okay, so car-free living, mm-hmm. what would you say is the percentage of people that actually don't own a car, don't use a car in San Francisco?
In the last census, which was at the height of the dot-com boom, we had about 28% of households had no car. It varies in different neighborhoods. Right here, you know, 6th of the Market, it's 70% of residents don't own a car. The Mission District, where I live, it's about half and half. Other parts of the city, you know, again, the hilly areas or the more affluent areas away from transit, it's higher. But certainly it's about, historically, it's been about a third for the past few decades.
Yeah, and we don't know the figures for New York, but I assume they're pretty high. We always compare San Francisco to New York and Chicago mm-hmm. and the other big transit cities.
Yeah, we're not at New York's level, I'm sure, in terms of the number of car-free households. They're probably the highest in the country, although I don't know that. And then, but we do pretty well in terms of the ranks of big cities. You know, we are a California city, and the Bay Area is mostly sprawly, but. We also have made a big investment in public transit in this region, and downtown, for example, about two-thirds of the people who work downtown are walking, cycling, or taking transit to get to work, which is huge. I was at a transit conference.
Is that true, really? That
yeah.
many?
Yeah, I was at a transit conference in Europe, and I was asked by a fellow from Manchester in Britain. He says, "What's your modal split into downtown?" I said, "Well, you know, two-thirds." And he was astounded that's kind of unparalleled in Britain. With the exception of London. So in some areas, we're definitely a very transit-oriented city. It can, as somebody who rides transit, walks and cycles, you know, you often feel like this city's definitely not designed for you. Mm-hmm. And you definitely get the feeling that people who are walking, cycling, and taking transit are doing so sort of despite the official kind of disdain for those modes. But the fact is this city works. You can get around with these sustainable modes. And a lot of people are doing that. Some people who, you know, don't have a choice, they can't afford a car, they're too young, they're too old, they're disabled. And then a lot of people who are making a choice, just, I want to live here car-free. And I think for a lot of people, for me, I grew up in the San Fernando Valley, so I was a suburban kid. Mm-hmm. I wanted to live in a real city, and this is the closest thing I could find with an agreeable climate.
Yeah, it is a real city. It's that we have a density that makes it possible to have transit. Mm-hmm. And it's really different from just... say right across the bay in Oakland, for instance, where they built it more on a Southern California model, I guess. Would you say that? Is that true?
Well, yes and no. I mean, Oakland was built, I think, a lot of it built like San Francisco. It was built originally as a rail-served city, and then a lot of the neighborhoods in Oakland are streetcar neighborhoods. But like Southern California, you know, the rail's gone, the streetcars are gone. We put BART in the 60s and 70s, but I think BART could have done better for Oakland than we did. I don't think there was a lot of thought put to where we placed the stations. And certainly official policy in Oakland has, you know, been much more embraced the automobile. They have built freeways as recently as the 1990s when we stopped in the early 1960s here. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, Oakland sort of, it's a sad case because you kind of see what Oakland was, what Oakland could have been, and then what Oakland is today. San Francisco went part of the way down that road, as it were, and mm-hmm. we stopped much earlier than Oakland.
And
Oakland,
we saw the Embarcadero freeway, and mm-hmm. everybody freaked out.
Right.
People saw the double-decker freeway taking over the waterfront. Mm-hmm. And the 60s, early 60s, we had the famous mm-hmm. freeway revolt.
Right.
Which sort of continues to this day. We have that spirit still in this town, I guess.
Yeah, I was... well, we had the 89 quake, and sort of the big earthquake happened during the World Series, so a lot of people saw it. And that damaged portions of... one freeway collapsed in Oakland, which was then rebuilt elsewhere, but rebuilt, and it damaged portions of three freeways in San Francisco, one of which was the Embarcadero, which you mentioned, which is now a beautiful waterfront boulevard. Mm-hmm. The other was the Central Freeway, which after three ballot measures, which Robin Levitt and I, Patricia Walkup, a whole group of other people worked on those and tried to convince the city. And we won narrowly, but we did win and got a boulevard alternative. So we pulled that freeway down, replaced it with the boulevard, which was opened earlier this year. And lastly, a piece of Interstate 280. All those freeways were removed. So absolutely, that idea of the city that spawned the freeway revolt did come around when the opportunity presented itself, and we got rid of a little bit more.
And even in Oakland, where the Cypress structure mm-hmm. fell down in the earthquake, many people were killed. It's not there anymore. They mm-hmm. moved it to another location. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure where that is, but mm-hmm. since I don't drive, mm-hmm. but West Oakland looks a lot. West Oakland has a lot of healing to do still, but it's amazing what happened when that freeway was removed. They replaced it with a sort of a boulevard, I guess, a parkway, yeah. I guess they would call it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a parkway. There's what they call the Mandela, Mandela Plaza, Mandela Village, right next to the BART station there. Yeah, all that's on land that was freed by the removal of the freeway. Yeah. And it's still knitting itself together. I mean, these cities change very slowly. And so, you know, when you kind of remove the blight, sometimes you see a neighborhood just come back, like the way Hayes Valley did when they removed the overhead freeway. Yeah. This was a kind of down-at-heels neighborhood with a lot of boarded-up storefronts. Now it's, you know, $800 shoes.
Now the danger is that it's going to be too gentrified, yeah.
Exactly. But that was just, you know, it sort of removed the blight, and the neighborhood just comes roaring back. And, you know, as they build on those sites, it's getting harder and harder to even see where those freeways were. Other places like West Oakland will take longer to come back, but they're definitely coming back. So the idea that you can, you know, heal these cities, you can knit them back together, is a big one. And we're not the only city to tear down freeways. We're one of the biggest cities to tear them down and not replace them. But I was just in New York, and the West Side Highway, you know, which was originally going to be the West Way, and they had these very ambitious plans to put it underground. At some point, they just said, we give up. We'll do a surface-level roadway. And that's kind of amazing to see, New York City kind of reorienting itself to the water.
There's a nice bikeway along the side of that mm-hmm. now.
Beautiful bikeway. That's one of the things I'd love to have here in our city along our waterfront would be a bikeway like that. Boston did the big dig, and you know, Boston gets a lot of, you know, kudos for their ambition, I guess, doing this. But I think San Francisco was a little more radical. We tore the freeway out and didn't replace it. They actually built more freeway than they had before. It just happens to be underground and at great expense.
In Boston. Yeah.
Yes.
So, I guess the advantage here is that we have a city that's sort of European in, mm-hmm. in scale. The streets were all mm-hmm. were designed before the advent of the automobile. Mm-hmm. And if you've ever seen the old movie of Market Street in 1905, there really isn't even a sidewalk. People lived in the street. Mm-hmm. People, you know, they walked in the street. They stood around in groups and talked to people. Mm-hmm. It's an amazing movie. But the thing is that these streets have been sort of taken since then. The streets you could see in that old movie, which I'm going to one of these days podcast, mm-hmm. You could see that the streets were still lived in by people, and mm-hmm. now it's been taken over by the cars. You look at Market Street or San Jose mm-hmm. Avenue or any of these, or even Feller Oak Street, mm-hmm. and they don't seem complete. They just seem like they've got cars. So TLC would like to complete the streets. What exactly is a complete street?
Sure. I mean, the downside, I would say, of the freeway revolt was as soon as we told the traffic engineers, well, you can't have these freeways, what they did was basically co-opt our street system and turn the street system into a series of freeways. That in this neighborhood has it particularly bad in terms of these traffic sewer streets with four lanes of one-way traffic. So take two parallel streets on a grid, one goes one way, the other goes the other way. Mm-hmm. Well, that's your way of kind of having freeway levels of traffic without having freeways, which, you know, maybe that's to our credit. Yeah, we didn't build the freeways, but the problem is we've still kind of made these neighborhoods a lot less livable. So a complete street is a term that started with the Thunderhead Alliance, of which we're a member, a national bicycle and pedestrian advocacy organization. But a complete street in their estimation or their definition is one that accommodates all users safely. So the idea is you don't just design it. It's not a street designed by traffic engineers, but it's a street designed for cyclists, for pedestrians, for transit users, so that they can use that.
Wider definition of traffic.
Right, right. All modes of transportation. And I think we give it another twist in terms of trying to look at the social life of streets, the economic life of streets, and the environmental or ecological life of streets. So in terms of sociability, Don Appleyard, who was a Cal professor, did a great book called Livable Streets in the 1970s, where he looked at parallel streets that had basically the same characteristics in terms of who lives there and the same design of buildings, but he found on these heavily trafficked streets, people didn't know their neighbors. They didn't hang out front, etc. So that whole kind of life of the streets, the idea that, that's where children are socialized, where you talk to your neighbors, all of that sort of stuff, the stuff that Jane Jacobs write about in her Hudson Street neighborhood. If you have too much traffic, you kill that. You know, you kill that sociability. You create a city of strangers.
Mm-hmm. Well, we had a really hard time organizing San Jose Avenue for bike lanes because nobody knew each other.
Right, right. Yeah, you had a street of garage doors that had really, people had sort of abandoned that street as being anything other than just a big thoroughfare. The other thing is the economic life of streets. There is a lot of data, mostly coming from Europe, but increasingly in the U.S. The Main Street program that the National Trust runs talks about this. Project for Public Spaces talk about this. But streets that are designed well, that have calm traffic, that have wide sidewalks, that have good lighting, street trees, kind of pedestrian amenities, are the streets that do best economically. So for every kind of bad pedestrianized street we have, and there's a few, you know, people kind of say pedestrianization doesn't work. I think we have a lot more neighborhood commercial districts in Oakland, here in San Francisco, et cetera, that we've killed with excessive traffic. So one thing we're trying to do, slow the traffic down on these streets, like Valencia, which was calmed by the addition of bike lanes in the 80s. We're trying to go another step and say, okay, widen the sidewalks, bulb the corners out, look at the lighting, you know, put street trees in. You sometimes have whole blocks where there's like kind of one little sickly tree per block. So green it up and restore the economic life of those streets and these neighborhoods. And the last is, of course, environmental. We're really looking at streets are about 11% of the city's area and account for a huge percentage of the runoff that comes. You know, water can't soak into the ground if it's running off asphalt. So we're trying to increase stormwater infiltration, to decrease flooding, to decrease sewage outflows into the bay. And we're also trying to, you know, green streets up in terms of a continuous canopy of trees, you know, get rid of the urban heat island effect, which is not so much a problem in San Francisco, but a problem in other cities. Improve air quality, improve livability of the streets that way. So the idea of how you reallocate the space on the street from just roads and asphalt to wider sidewalks to more greenery to all of that is another thing that we're hoping to do. So one of our other initiatives sort of outside those four that I talked about is this idea of a greenway network, that these streets can be, if you think like a complete street, you know, that they can be part of the open space network, that they're kind of just streets should be designed so they're just delightful to walk on, you know, that they're urban promenades, that they can be transportation means, the most popular forms of exercise for people. And what they've said they want over and over in polls in San Francisco is they want areas where it's safe to walk and run and bicycle. So can we make our streets better for those things? So the idea is just take away the monopoly that the automobile has had on the use of streets and restore all those other uses, all those other functions, all those other aspects of a street. That's a complete street, the long answer. Yeah,
that's a good answer. But the way you arrive at that, you got two different prongs here. You're trying to promote car-free living and better transit, and that's the carrot. And then on the stick side, you're trying to remove, I don't know if it's really a stick, but trying to remove the parking requirements that are necessary in the city. Where in like New York, you look at the New York and you see a city that was built before the car was came on the scene, and they already had a subway and they already had the IRT and the, all these different train systems, and so it organically grew that way. Whereas here we have to sort of do some social there already was some social engineering in the direction we didn't want to go, but now we need to reverse it. So maybe you could talk about, well, let's start with the stick and talk about parking, and then we'll
Well, one of the things that we did, and I think there was a redoing of the parking requirements. And New York City had this problem too, in the sense of in the 1930s, they had Robert Moses. So they built a huge subway network in the city, and they built a huge commuter rail network for the city starting in the late part of the 19th century and going into the 1930s. But from the 1930s to the 1990s, they didn't build another subway line or another subway station. So Robert Moses tried to co-opt New York and turn it into a city for the automobile. And you saw a lot of the same things happen in New York, like in the Bronx, where they demolished huge sections of neighborhoods to build freeways through. So even New York is kind of trying to claw back to, you know, where they started, to a more sustainable and more livable place. But clearly it got a lot further here. And so one of the things we're looking at a few things in the area of parking. One is, why do we underprice parking? And we have a habit in San Francisco, officially, of sort of pricing parking really cheap at meters or in city-owned lots and garages, and then running out of it. So it's kind of a Soviet style of parking management. You underprice it, and then you manage by shortage. Mm-hmm. So it's like bread in the Soviet Union. It's really cheap, but you have to wait in line for, you know, a week to get it. We do that with parking here, and we're saying, well, stop doing that, right? Just use, let the market determine the price. It does two things. One is it encourages people to use other modes by getting this artificial subsidy for driving and parking. The other thing is it means parking is available. And when you talk to merchants about this and say, yeah, we want to manage parking, you know, not to punish people who drive, but if you manage parking so that you set the price so there's always spaces available, then anyone who knows, who comes, knows they may have to pay more, maybe a good deal more, but they're going to get a space as opposed to the kind of, you know, drive around the block eight times kind of scenario that we have now. So looking at pricing on city-owned lots and garages, the other thing that we're looking at is requirements. So when you build a building in San Francisco...
That's the biggie.
Yes, that, well, that's the biggie. It's really hot right now. But for virtually every use in San Francisco and in virtually every neighborhood in San Francisco, there are minimum parking requirements for new buildings. If you build a shop, if you build an office building, if you build a residence, you have to have built some parking along with it. The city in the 1980s did something really bold in its downtown, and this is one of the reasons we're one of the most successful transit cities in the country. The downtown plan in the 1980s said, okay, we're going to get rid of the minimum parking requirements for offices, and we're going to establish a maximum parking requirement. We don't want parking in the downtown for offices. And having done that, we saw huge growth in the 1980s and 1990s in terms of the amount of office going in, but we didn't see a commensurate increase in traffic. And the reason was we brought everybody in on transit because we already had BART, and then they made additional investments. We've extended BART, we've extended Muni Metro, we've extended the ferries. So the transit system gets bigger, more development goes in, but traffic didn't increase because they used parking as the lever. We think that works on the resident side as well. So in the downtown, working with Supervisor Daley, we sponsored a piece of legislation, which is probably the biggest parking reform in a generation, which says that, same as with office in the downtown, we're going to get rid of the minimum parking requirement, which was low but still existed.
So for every house, every apartment, every unit that you you build, you won't be required to build a parking spot for it, or it'll be a lower ratio.
In the downtown, it was the minimum requirement was one space for every four units. So now there'll be no minimum. You can build parking entirely car-free if you want. We want to establish a maximum parking requirement, which didn't exist before. There was, the sky was the limit in terms of, once you got a planning approval called a conditional use, you could go as high as you want. We said, well, there should be a realistic limit. We talked about, originally talked about one space for every other unit. We now are at a proposal that the Planning Commission felt was a good one for the time being, and we don't disagree, which is three spaces for every four units, but there should be a maximum. We also want to require the unbundling of parking. So getting back to that whole question of sort of building congestion into the DNA of cities, you know, unbundling means that whenever you buy an apartment or rent an apartment, that the purchase or rental of a parking space would be a separate transaction. Mm-hmm. So that if you want to move in there and rent a space, you don't need a car, then you don't pay for the parking space. But if you want the parking space, you pay for it separately. And that does two things. One is make housing more affordable for people who don't own cars, which is the car-free living mm-hmm. idea. The other thing is it does is kind of encourages people to think about that transaction. Do you need the car? You know, and if you mm-hmm. have a free space, you're paying for it anyway. You know, you might just keep your car. If you don't really need your car, you're on that cusp of decision, then you might just say, hey, I don't want to pay for the parking space. I'll get rid of it. So it really encourages kind of more sustainable transportation behavior.
And as far as housing goes, you're creating mm-hmm. more space for housing and less space, less. You're not housing cars as mm-hmm. much as people.
That's correct. The cost of constructing a space in San Francisco is astronomical, probably $50,000 to $70,000. We're not quite sure, but that's so if you get rid of that huge cost, those are savings that are passed on to the buyers of these units, as we've found from studies. The car-free units sell for less. The other thing is, we don't by not building the spaces, it's more room. You know, one of the constraints in downtown San Francisco is don't have a lot of room to build. You got to go up or you got to go down, meaning underground. And so limiting the amount of parking, we're limiting parking to the ground floor and below. We're saying you have to wrap it in active uses, so no blank facades where you're staring in a grate at cars, but wrap it in storefronts. Again, that idea of walkability mm-hmm. and complete streets. But the idea is usable space that can be used to house people or house jobs. We don't want that taken up by cars. In a place like downtown where we've spent billions of dollars extending transit, we should use the land wisely. So this is about kind of wise use of that resource, which is space.
Yeah, so cutting back on the amount mm-hmm. of parking is not going to create congestion, as some people think.
No, it actually creates the reverse. And we worked with some San Francisco State students this year, because we had sort of heard a rather self-serving and anecdotal argument from the development lobby, which is, this is just car storage, that people who live downtown don't use these cars. But we didn't think that made sense, just because almost all the new projects are unbundled. Although it's not a requirement, they've required that project by project. So people are paying a lot of money to both own a car and then to store it somewhere downtown. So we were figuring out people are using it. So some San Francisco State students looked at projects with some with one space per dwelling unit and some other projects with considerably less than one space per dwelling unit. And in their study, they found, first of all, cars get used, that every parking space is generating between a trip and half a trip a day. So no cars just sort of sit there and sort of quietly rust underground, and these cars are getting used and they're generating a lot of trips. The other thing we found is a lot of people who were moving into downtown were driving to work, which is strange to think about in the downtown. But I think it's sort of one of the problems we have is that we're becoming a bedroom community for Silicon Valley. And, mm-hmm.
A lot of people do the reverse commute down to, 30 miles down to Palo Alto.
Yeah, and we'd have no problem with that if they were hopping on Caltrain every morning. But if you are moving downtown and you're using your car at rush hour every morning, then you're contributing to traffic congestion and at the time of day where it's most congested. So certainly that's a kind of behavior or lifestyle choice that you're going to hit the wall with, that we can't do that much of that because you begin to quickly run into the capacity of the streets. So the idea that we had is, downtown's incredibly well transit served. It's walkable and could be more so if we could take some more of the street space away from cars. And so it should be a place that, for the people who are happy to live without a car or use it less frequently, it should be a place where you can kind of self-select to live. And if you, can't be without your car, well, first of all, there will be space in the downtown for you. We're not saying no cars in new development. We're just saying fewer. You got the rest of the Bay Area to choose from, as well as Los Angeles and Fresno and Salt Lake City and all those other places. So, but the idea that we could design, one great neighborhood, one really great walkable car-free neighborhood, or if not car-free, a place to live car-free, and feeling like that should be downtown.
Yeah. I don't know if I said it in this take, but it seems like the most successful cities are the ones that don't have a lot of parking, where the parking is a real problem, where people can't
people complain about parking a lot, that's usually a sign that you're living in a successful, vibrant, happy city.
Yeah, it's funny to hear merchants complain, because it's, you know, it's always the Yogi Berra paradox of, like, it's so crowded no one goes there anymore. You know, just that our customers can't get here because there's no parking and there's no space on the roads. And you're like, well, you know, those are all your customers. You know,
if you go to Oakland, you see that there's a parking lot every block.
Yeah.
Several parking lots every block, yet there's nobody on the street.
Yeah.
And there's closed up storefronts, and they can't even get Sears to mm-hmm. be a success there.
And the smarter downtowns, these kind of suburban downtowns, but the older suburbs or the mature suburbs, the Palo Altos and the Mountain Views and Berkeley and, Hayward, have figured out that, yeah, you know, it's not the key to downtown revitalization is not parking, it's walkability, mm-hmm. you know, make it a nice place to walk. So I think what you're seeing in all those cities is this movement towards urbanism, you know, towards mm-hmm. having continuous street facades, so you're looking in windows, not looking at cars, mm-hmm. To have wide sidewalks, to create a nice pedestrian environment, you know, the kind of historic, play up the historic character of the neighborhoods. It's a strategy that's working virtually everywhere. We don't do enough of that here. We have some neighborhoods, like we're working with these Columbus Avenue neighbors in North Beach. And again, Columbus Avenue in North Beach, just totally charming, wonderful place. Zillions of people want to go there. It's fantastic. But it's not because we've really invested any energy attention in the streetscape. You've got very skinny sidewalks. It's not very walkable or anything. And the merchants there get that, you know, they're never going to be an auto-oriented neighborhood. They're never going to be able to compete with the suburban shopping malls or suburban mm-hmm. shopping districts on the suburban terms, but they think on purely urban terms, they're more than competitive. And they want to play up the urbanity of Columbus Avenue, really make it a great walkable place. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of the road not traveled here in San Francisco. And again, it's something that we're working with neighborhood groups around the city. The San Jose Guerrero Group was one where they're trying to kind of reclaim that street for... to create more of a residential neighborhood and sustain what retail there is there. On Valencia, it's a commercial revitalization, and same thing with Columbus, a commercial revitalization. But complete streets should be our economic development strategy here in San Francisco, and unfortunately they're not yet, but you know, it's coming.
So maybe we need to talk about mm-hmm. you know, I mischaracterized that as a stick, because it sounds like more of a carrot actually the way you explained it. But the other carrot is transportation.
They're all carrots, yes.
Yeah.
No sticks. We're totally nonviolent here.
So we're looking I guess right now the hot topic is Geary Boulevard, the bus rapid transit.
Yes. Yeah, Geary is an interesting case. It's for any single bus line in San Francisco, it is the bus line that carries the most people. About 50,000 people a day use that bus line. It's not a great line in the sense the service is very frequent, you know, every 2 or 3 minutes, but the buses are very crowded. They're not particularly reliable, and they get caught in traffic. So at peak period, it can take 50 minutes to get from Market Street to the beach, which is too long.
And this is the bus line that connects the area that was against mm-hmm. taking down the Central Freeway to the downtown.
Right. More conservative west side of town. So this was the Richmond District, which together with the Sunset District, two west side neighborhoods that are more auto-oriented. They were built later mm-hmm. than the neighborhood we're in now.
Early suburbs, yeah.
Yeah. Streetcar suburbs originally, but later kind of filled in the non-streetcar bits with auto-oriented stuff. So those neighborhoods, yeah, people drove through the Hayes Valley neighborhood on their way to the Richmond and the Sunset, and they were opposed to this. But this Geary corridor, you know, there was a light rail line down Geary. And in fact, I think the tracks were taken out. They may exist still in places, but they shut down streetcar service in the 70s on Geary and replaced it with bus service. The buses are amazingly successful. It's not one of these things that we need to sort of create mm-hmm. transit ridership where there is none. But I think it's an issue where we can, if we improve transit service significantly, we could capture a lot more riders and, again, support the economic development of that area.
And we'd be able to complete, to use your term, streets like Felon Oak, for instance.
Right, and complete Geary. I mean, it does have shops more or less all the way down it, but it really, you know, walking down that street, it's definitely a highway engineer designed street. You know, got mm-hmm. those sort of cobra lights, the very high light poles with that kind of ugly yellowish light. Mm-hmm. sidewalks aren't very wide.
But there is some commerce on that street, and there are people that walk there.
Absolutely.
And it's just a block over from some restaurant streets.
Yeah, and it's got interesting restaurants on it. You see more big box retail going in on Geary, which is a sign that they probably haven't made it as pedestrian friendly as they should. So things like BevMo and all of that going in. But certainly Geary needs that complete street approach. We need to figure out a way to make the rapid transit work on that street, but... It's a street in the bike network, although it doesn't have any bike improvements. That's another thing we'd like to work
on. It's a nightmare to ride your bike on.
Right. And it should be a great walking street. I mean, it's a good street to walk down.
It could be the Champs-Élysées.
It could be.
Although the Champs-Élysées has a little bit too much traffic, too, but it could have that feel.
Yeah, absolutely. It should be a kind of a grand boulevard for the city.
So the solution, what we're looking at is a bus rapid transit system,
right,
which is what?
Bus rapid transit is a sort of, it's a way of giving buses more of the characteristics of light rail. So bus rapid transit typically has more widely spaced stops than the bus does. So it doesn't stop on every block, stops every
You pay in advance, but it has a dedicated roadway.
Yeah, dedicated right of way. So the idea of a reserved median or lanes on the side. They're looking at both alternatives for Geary, but dedicated lanes. So you're not.
You pay before you get on too.
That maybe the problem with bus rapid transit in San Francisco is the we use the term, but we don't do all of the bits. You know, so the idea of a complete street, you know, is a complete bus rapid transit would mean you would have low floor vehicles so you can easily get on and off.
Stations, like train stations.
Mm-hmm. Little stations, you'd open multiple doors on the side of a bus so you can get large numbers of people on and off. You'd pay your fare in advance or you'd have proof of payment so that you wouldn't have to sort of talk to the driver on each, you know, transaction, mm-hmm. but get people on and off quickly. The reserved medians, the wide spacing, all of that.
The lights turn green automatically as you go.
Signal preempts, that there's real-time transit information at the stop. So it's sort of a whole bunch of kind of complementary strategies that add up to a line that's a much higher amenity than the line you have now and provides you with much better service. So the bus rapid transit's being planned. We're keeping track of it for two reasons. One is, you know, as I said earlier, Geary needs to be a complete street, and we have a habit in San Francisco of kind of planning for one transportation mode at a time, usually the automobile, but even sometimes when they improve a street for transit, they don't look at the pedestrian or bicycle improvements or vice versa. Mm-hmm. You know, they plan a street for bikes, don't look at the ped improvements or anything.
That's where I'm steering this, because I'm thinking we need a bike lane along that road as well.
Absolutely.
That's not in the plans right now. It's something we need to push for.
Yeah, and again, it would be complementary. There's a certain reluctance on the part of muni planners to have...
That's the municipal railway again.
Right, the bus agency. Bus and rail here in San Francisco. But there is a reluctance on their part to have streets that are heavily bus and bike streets because bikes want to be in the right lane, as do buses. And bus rapid transit, especially if you put the transit in a reserved median, well, then those become complementary. So we've had a kind of long-standing look at Market Street, which is sort of used to be the main commercial street in San Francisco, although it isn't now. Should be again. It's certainly the main transit street in San Francisco, but it's also the biggest bike street in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. So the idea of trying to straighten out Market and minimize the conflicts between buses and bikes and cars and pedestrians on that street has been an ongoing thing because very disjointed approach on the part of the city. So we identified a set of 10 incremental steps that we can take. We and the Bike Coalition are working with the Transportation Authority to do those. But I think in the future we'll want a more thorough redesign of Market. But certainly with Geary, I think you're looking at another street that, at least for a portion of it, is going to be a bike street, a major transit street, major pedestrian street, and still have to carry a lot of cars. So can we make Geary a complete street? It'll be interesting to find out. And we're hoping that we've designed the last incomplete street in San Francisco, and that this will be the first complete one.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think we're out of time.
Very good.
Well, thanks for being
here. You're welcome. Oh, no problem.
I saw the bus riding off hour through the power. When the passengers make room, whisper bright and room, that's us on a bus. two in one seat. Love on every detour, you can be sure that I'll show you how it feels to honeymoon on wheels with two in one seat. Slow down, Route 27 is the nearest thing to heaven I know. Speed up, start hitting 60 and my heart will jump and thump. Oh, oh, what a bump, us on a bus. Kisses intimating that we're waiting till it's time to light the lamps, hit the tourist camps. That's us on a bus, yeah.
Waller there for you on Bikescape. So thanks, Tom, for Tom Radulovich, Transportation for a Livable City, and that was a great conversation, and I hope to see him again sometime. That was actually the first time I've actually ever seriously sat down and talked to Tom, and he's a really smart guy and really great to have a conversation with him on Bikescape. So well, this time of year, there's not much happening. The SF Bike website seems to be not working right now, which is very unusual. But I know that there isn't really the winter party just happened. I got myself a nice new wool jersey, very nice, at the silent auction, and it was a big success. Ran into a lot of people. It's always the people you don't see for years, you always see there. That was kind of nice, and there isn't really much happening this time of year. People are out of town. People are going to parties. But in a lot of parts of the world, unlike San Francisco, it's cold and rainy and wet, which is one of the reasons we're going to be doing a podcast one of these days with some people up in New York. In Chicago, who are they do a thing called Bike Winter. You've heard of Bike Summer. Well, Bike Winter is where they try to promote winter bicycling, and they have little workshops and rides and fun things happening. So we'll be talking to some people up in Chicago about that probably the next podcast. What else is happening? Really not much. There's an action alert in New York. New York is still cracking down on cyclists. You can't park your bicycle on the parking meter right now. If you chain your bike up in New York, your biggest fear is not having the bicycle stolen by thieves, but having the police saw it off and cart it away. It says here on their website, currently bikes locked to signs, lampposts, and other fixtures are, quote, abandoned and subject to seizure under City Administrative Code 16122B. And there's a bill, 685, currently before the city council that would affirm cyclists' rights to lock their bikes to street fixtures. So they're waiting for a hearing on that bill at the city council transportation committee. So defend your right to lock up on the street and talk to your city council member. You can find your representative at www.nyccouncil.info and tell him to or her to support Bill 685. Also, Another sign of the times in New York, they're having an action alert. Time's Up is, that is, the pedestrian bicycle organization there. The city is considering a mandatory helmet law for all cyclists. And while Time's Up and Bikescape 2 strongly encourages helmet use, we're all concerned that a mandatory helmet law will reduce the number of cyclists on the street and increase bike crashes and deaths. So as the number of cyclists increases, motorists become used to the presence, you know, to our presence, and biking becomes safer. But studies have shown that mandatory helmet laws actually reduce cycling. Helmets don't cause collisions and are not a substitute for improved street design, which is where the real problem, of course, lies, as we just heard in this podcast. I think there's something about helmets that requiring them also makes people think that bicycling just isn't safe. Everybody has this image of bicycling as a very dangerous activity, and it's really not compared to, of course you should probably wear a helmet. I do sometimes, although not always, but and kids obviously should wear helmets. People who are not experienced cyclists should wear helmets, and probably everybody should wear helmets all the time. But if you look, this is a controversial thing to say, but, you know, if you look at, like, car crashes, it's, you know, empirically, there, you know, of the 37,000 odd car crashes a year, a good 80% of those are a result of head trauma. Yet you never hear anybody saying you need to wear a helmet in the car, you know. The one time in 40 years that I've actually been injured on a bicycle, I broke a collarbone, and I wish I was wearing a helmet on my shoulder. Or shoulder pads or something, but the idea of actually forcing this is just anathema to me. So I don't know, maybe you don't feel the same way, but if you do, as Time's Up says, it's time to nip this one in the bud. So you want to talk to Health and Mental Hygiene Commissioner Thomas Frieden and tell him how you feel. So I will put a link on the blog, bikescape.blogspot.com. And you can go there, and you can also check the Bike Coalition San Francisco website, and we'll have links to transportation to livable cities and to the Transportation Authority here in San Francisco. It's too late for anybody here to go to one of their hearings about the BRT, the Geary bus line that Tom was talking about, but there is an online questionnaire on their website, so check the blog for coordinates for a link to that. To that website, they have an online, well, it's more than a questionnaire, they're calling it a workshop, an online workshop. So you actually register and answer the questions, and I think there's a little bit of back and forth. I haven't done it yet, but I will. So definitely want to get those bike lanes on this, you know, going along the side of the BRT, the Bus Rapid Transit line on Geary Boulevard. It's one of those opportunities where we have to do it now, and it might be too late later after the street's redesigned. So keep those cards and letters coming to bikescape@sbcglobal.net. This particular show came as a result of a suggestion by Gladwin D'Souza. Thank you, Gladwin, for that. You sent me an email about 2 months ago about engineering, and one thing led to another, and it sort of turned into this podcast. But it was all because of you. And Walter, wanted to know what that song was in the last podcast, Bicycles, right after my little interview with my son Theo. That was a song called Bicycle, and oddly enough, and it's by a band called Filbryte, P-F-I-L-B-R-Y-T-E, from their album Preservatives Affirmative. I'll also put a link to, iTunes or something. I'll try and get that up there on the website. If you don't see it right away, check back in a day or two. I'm a very busy man these days. And that does it for another podcast of Bikescape. Really appreciate you all sticking with it all these years. It's going to be a year in February. And listening all the time. And spread the word. I would love to push the numbers up. We're up to about 550, 600 subscribers right now. I don't know how many people actually listen without subscribing, but it would be really nice to get more people. More is good, right? It isn't. It is, right? It is. Yes, I think so. So here's a song for all you traffic calmers out there. Oh, I'll put a link to this one as well. This is, I think it's public domain. It's not public domain, but I think it's PodSafe, I think. So hopefully you'll go out and buy this guy's record. I'll put a link to his website. Slow down. Slow down.
When life is getting you down, you make a big frown, well, don't you? Well, I've got a cure as to how to endure all the troubles that life would surround you with. So you've got all of these problems. Well, I've got a way to resolve them. Just lend me your ears, dear, and hear me explain. All the troubles you have won't remain if you slow down. Slow down. Slow down. Ooh. Advances have made us all faster. More than ever now, we need to take the time to get away. The world's always going to keep moving. So what on this earth are you proving? When nothing you could ever do could ever be as soothing as when nothing is exactly what you're doing. So slow down.